VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
You're listening to The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and The Sunday Times. Now with goals.
I'm Gabriel McCaughey with a football podcast from The Times where Premier League fans can get every goal, every game, everywhere. Now, before we start, a reminder that we're going on the road. At least Rory and I are initially, and we'll be joined by Dion Dublin in Birmingham a week from Thursday. But we'll also be heading to George Calkins' gaff up in Newcastle and also in lovely Manchester, which I believe is close to where Ollie Kay lives. And I hope he'll pay us a visit. Now, tickets cost £5 for Times Plus members, £7.50 for non-members. To book, you can visit www.ctickets.com/thetimes, or better yet, call 0871-620-4025 and speak to a real live human being. Expect some great guests, myself, and of course, not just that, but Rory Smith as well. Hopefully as often as possible. Back to this week, and a welcome to my guests, Tony Cascarino, Ollie Kay, speaking to us from his conservatory in Rippendon, and Rory K. Smith. Let's kick off with England. So it's now Monday, and on Friday, England beat Montenegro 4-1, putting them in a very favorable position to actually qualify without having to go through the playoffs and prolonging the agony. That was a very understrength Montenegro side, but it was still, par for the course, a convincing England victory. Rory, let's start with you, since you're such an England fan.
Yeah, they were kind of okay, weren't they? And they did what they had to. I think what was strange for me was that Montenegro looked much more comfortable on the ball on the occasions when they had the ball than England, although England had much more of the ball, which I think is quite worrying. But no, England kind of did what they had to do. There seem to be two gears with England, and that's either total kind of resigned depression or complete triumphalism, we're going to win the World Cup nonsense. Neither really applies. I think they will qualify. They haven't qualified particularly well. Even if they beat Poland convincingly, they haven't qualified particularly well. They're not going to win it. They're not going to do anything particularly special in Brazil, barring some sort of huge turnaround.
What are you, Nostradamus? I mean,
No, but there's nothing. Even with Townsend, I mean, Townsend kind of exemplifies it. He's decent, but he's not.
We'll get to Townsend in a minute. Ollie, I looked at the England lineup and I thought, I wasn't expecting it, but then again, I don't live with the England team the way you do. But I thought, this is a very attacking lineup, rather un-Roy-like. And I looked at this and part of me wanted to praise him, and of course they needed to win and gamble a little bit. By the same token, kind of also, part of me also said, well, you've been in charge for 18 months. You should have a team and an identity that's kind of for all seasons and that, you know, could go out and beat Montenegro, but maybe that's not the case. It was obviously vindicated by that attacking lineup, right?
Well, yeah, I think Cass made a very interesting and perceptive point on a Saturday morning in the paper where he pointed out that you don't know what kind of England you're going to get from one game to the next, not just in terms of quality of performance, but in terms of the approach. I mean, they were turgid and direct in Ukraine, and they were sort of more incisive and short passing and attacking on the front foot against Montenegro on Friday. And, you know, we all encourage tactical flexibility, but to me, those are, you know, it's been a fairly big lurch from one type of performance to another in this qualifying campaign. And I mean, I thought they did well on Friday. I wouldn't go crazy. I wouldn't go overboard, and I certainly wouldn't suggest that they're going to win the World Cup or even reach the last eight. But it was a performance that made you think that, you know, should they, you know, all things being equal on Tuesday, they shouldn't screw it up and they should be at the World Cup without need for the playoffs.
Cass, does it matter that Montenegro were, I mean, you can only beat what's in front of you, right? Does it matter Montenegro were missing basically half their starting lineup, and especially in the case of Montenegro, given the size of the nation, and you'll know this having played for the Republic, when you're that size, if you have, you know, if you lose some starters, you may have a decent starting 11, but if you lose some starters, the guys replacing them might be people who play in the third flight, or in the case of Montenegro, you know, a goalkeeper who started one game in the last 3 years, two guys without who are currently unattached because nobody can't get contracts. That's the reality, right?
Yeah, it is the reality. But you also have to deal with guys that see the golden goose in England and the league, and maybe if they put on a performance that can shine, that they can find themselves playing in the Premier League.
They
one
all
day.
Want to go to the Premier League.
Well, no, but it's a major league. Not all want to go to the Premier League. It's a major league.
It's like watching Sky.
No.
Listening to you.
Well, I'm sorry. but that's what you're dealing with. Right. I mean, I thought they, like what the boys said, you know, technically, is, you know, they were not bad. But you expect that. I always felt Eastern Bloc countries, they never shone away from wanting the ball. I found it difficult to watch because I'm such a saddo, I put the Ukraine game and I put the Montenegro game on at the same time and watched them.
You own more than one television.
Yeah. And I found the contrast in styles amazing of England, the way they played and the way they tried to make an impact on the game. And I just felt, when Ollie said about, you know, what sort of England are going to play and their style, I don't think they've identified a style. I thought it was, look, these are weaker, they've got players out, we're going to be very adventurous. It was a totally un-Roy-like team. I've never seen him, and you touched on being bold. I was amazed that he selected the side he did, because I didn't see that coming. Would they do that against a far better team with a more complete side? I doubt it very much, because I still think that Roy will always opt for caution against certain opposition of a higher calibre.
Andros Townsend was a guy who came in, and it was interesting because some members of the media, and I have to say, Ollie, forgive me, I did not read your copy on Friday, but some people commented that
appalling.
That Townsend would be coming in, and then I read on a football website, on Football 365, this absolute, like, sort of destruction of Townsend, and I thought they made a good point. Here's a guy who is 22 years old, he's played 18 top flight games. He has three starts at under 21 level. I know he's been loaned out to like 10 different teams. He's taken more shots on goal than anybody else in the Premier League, and he's not a center forward and hasn't scored yet. What does it say when somebody like that gets – and it obviously worked out, so obviously Roy's vindicated. Mm-hmm. But at this stage of qualification, you have to chuck somebody like that in there. Is it a hit and hope type thing, Ollie?
Well, it is, and it also shows that the cupboard is fairly bare. I mean, in terms of talent, which is something that has been said many times. I mean, it's not exactly a huge injury crisis or a huge personnel crisis that has taken Townsend to the front of the queue. It's Walcott's out and Oxlade-Chamberlain's out, and you could previously cite Oxlade-Chamberlain as somebody who hasn't exactly set the Premier League alight yet is in the England squad. You could easily say of Walcott, in fact. I mean, the bar is not exactly set very high for young Premier League players, particularly at top clubs, wanting to break into the England squad and indeed team. And Townsend is just the latest to find that all it probably takes is a few good weeks at a top club and you're in the England squad and you've got a chance of starting a big game like this. And I thought Townsend did extremely well, but there would have been a time not so long ago where you would need to play at that level for an awfully long time before you were starting.
Well, if you look at the contrast with Spain, where Michu's had to play in the Premier League, so 2 years in the Premier League, or a year in the Premier League and then another 3 months, as the, you know, one of the best strikers in one of the strongest leagues in the world, preceded by a season in which he was the leading scorer outside of Barcelona and Madrid for a team who, you know, should have been hopeless. And then after all that, he gets in the Spanish squad. Andros Townsend plays four times for Spurs and gets in the England team. That's instructive.
And Miju is still only sixth choice.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
For Spain. But, Roy, I know you spoke to Gary Southgate. There's a good piece in the paper with him. But I'm interested in this fact that Andros Townsend has three under-21 caps. Because is that an indictment of England at youth level?
Yes.
Because remember when James Milner had like 100 under-21 caps?
47, he got Milner, I think.
What was Townsend not on anybody's radar? I know he's had some issues, but like, well, it's kind of weird when you know. I mean, I think Tom Ince has said, you know, obviously Stuart Pearce made different decisions, but should England as an FA have noticed? Hey, look, this guy can play a little bit. Maybe get him on the pitch sometime.
Well, he's a funny one, Townsend, because you look at the. I think the fact that he's been loaned out, it certainly shouldn't be held against him, and in many ways is a good thing, as it's kind of it's given him chance to play, and I think it's much better that a player like that is out in the Championship playing for Yeovil or whoever, rather than sort of sitting in Spurs' under-21 squad doing nothing. That's a good thing. But by the same token, the amount of times he's been loaned out makes you wonder whether Spurs actually ever thought he was going to make it particularly. That's not the path that most kind of top young prospects take. Maybe one loan, maybe two, not seven or eight. Well, that's quite rare.
I think he also had some pretty high-profile fallings out with Roy Keane and Neil Warnock.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, one was maybe my favorite footballer ever from the British Isles. The other one is apparently highly respected, Neil Warnock. Do you think Stuart Pearce of the FA looked in it and said, like, well, if Keno and Neil don't rate him, then there's no place for him in the under-21s?
Should they, if that's
their logic?
I think we're being really harsh on the lad. I mean, look. I think he was a guy that's obviously
harsh
had his
on the
issues.
I mean, harsh on the system.
Well,
I mean,
the system
we're doing. Like, but, the guy can obviously play a little bit, right?
Yes.
So, he showed it with and he rewarded Hodgson's faith in him on Friday night. Whether he'll do it again, I don't know. But it's obvious that Roy's talking about a dearth of talent and so on, and lack of depth is part of the reason why this guy gets a 22 and he hasn't played much international football. He hasn't been part of England squads. He probably hasn't felt.
There is a problem with England ignoring not just the 21s, but all of the age group teams, because we don't really sort of seem to think that youth football is particularly important at international level, whereas other countries bring generations through, and it means when they get to the top, to the senior side, that they know how to play together. But I don't think Townsend's a particularly good example of that.
He's
problem.
He's an outlier.
I think one of the major problems is, Gab, is that because people speak like they do in all industries, and I think a lot's been said about Townsend, and a lot of it underground, because these people have looked at him and said, pain in the backside. Problem.
Probably Neil not the Warnock, best judgment, given also that he was suspended for betting on football.
Of course. So he's done things that, you know, have caused him problems. Neil Warnock openly said that, you know, he left Leeds without even saying goodbye. He was on loan there and just packed up his bag and went back to London. You know, them things don't go down well, and people will then start looking, saying, what sort of attitude's the kid got? Does he really deserve to be part of the England group? Is he a problem?
I do wonder a little bit, because Daniel Sturridge, who everybody loves now, also definitely had a reputation like that when he was younger. I know, I'm just throwing it out there. When you have talent, should they maybe be nurtured a little bit differently to make sure that these people do emerge?
But you do have to question whether any man can be a normal human being if he'd leave Leeds at all. Once you're there, you stay.
Well, let's get it right. Let's look at how it's all come about. Harry Redknapp took him at QPR, believed in his talent, gave him the platform. He then shone at QPR because he did play well, and you can't deny that. He was excellent for QPR and played a big part in their season, even though they got relegated. He played a big part in changing, and Harry saw something that he really believed was a top player. He's gone back to Tottenham. Now, Gareth Bale left the football club, and I think that probably it's a wake-up call for Townsend, where he's probably got, do you know what? I've got a fantastic opportunity. I need to grow up now. And he had done some daft stuff. Now, I think he's been given an opportunity, which he's jumped at, but there were certain issues that a lot of people are afraid of what he would do. You know, how can you take along a player who's suddenly going to give you problems in the England under-21s?
Ollie, I want to throw it forward to something else. Dejan Savicevic, one of the most, I think, one of the most naturally gifted players, certainly of my lifetime, he came out with his typical sort of, I want to be fair to the guy, but it is typical sort of chest-beating small nation saying that, you know, the Montenegrins are all proud to play for Montenegro. It's the most important thing for them. And the English guys, they don't care about the shirt so much. You could disagree, you can agree. But I was struck by the fact that Roy got so wound up over this. Does this say tell us anything about his mindset? Is there anything to read into this? Did he waste a good opportunity to keep his mouth shut?
Well, I think Roy gets upset by what he considers cheap shots at his team and his management, etc. I mean, I think there are various things that he and the team are accused of. And personally, I would agree with Hodgson that a lack of dedication or a lack of commitment shouldn't be one of them. I think it's one of those extremely lazy things that people say after, you know, when they see England teams playing poorly, that, you know, they don't care, they don't, they're not bothered. Where's the passion? Where's the belief? Sometimes I think that the passion is about all they've got. You know, you go back to the 2010 World Cup. I don't think they struggled there because of a lack of passion, commitment, dedication, whatever. So, although there is a very sort of serious and deep conversation to be had about what the England team means to in English football and whether it is the player's priority, I don't think there's ever really a lack of commitment to the cause when they're in that squad.
So Roy was right to respond.
Well, I don't know whether he was right to respond.
Well, that's what I'm asking you. Because
to be honest, I don't even particularly remember the original barb from Savicevic. So
Rory and I sat there reading all the Montenegro papers as we normally do for this game. I guess you missed out on that part.
I did.
I want to throw it forward to the Poland game because and you can tell that. I don't want to sound like our boss Tony Evans and say there's no football going on, but you can tell the cupboard is pretty bare right now, and so it's a huge issue now that, from what I saw on television this morning, 18,000 seats, which based on the attendance could be anywhere between a third to a fourth of Wembley, are going to go to fans of Poland. And part of the reason is that some of it is Poland's away allocation. Some of it is the fact that if, like me, you once bought a ticket to Wembley, you end up on this sort of mailing list from hell where they email you every few minutes and say, like, look, you can still buy tickets. You can still buy tickets. You can still buy tickets. And a bunch of Polish people living here, obviously there's a large Polish immigrant population who've settled here, they've bought tickets. And what the FA has done, I think quite intelligently, is rather than treating them like normal fans, they've said, well, if all these guys are Polish, maybe they should all kind of sit together, which kind of makes sense if they'll be presumably supporting Poland. Is this even a story? Is this even an issue?
There isn't a story in the sense that there'll be 18,000 Poles in there, although the way it's been built up is that it'll be to blame if England don't win. It'll be because the FA's incompetence or whatever, that's in inverted commas, has given the Poles a better atmosphere. It's less of a home game, blah, blah, blah. What is interesting is the fact that, and I guarantee this, although I'm not Nostradamus, the 20,000 Poles in Wembley will make an awful lot more noise than the 70,000 English people in Wembley. And that, like every Champions League home game, is a damning indictment of how silent English football fans are.
Thank you, Mr. Savicevic.
I was going to say, I mean, I wrote about it in this morning's paper. I think it is an issue. I think it is, you know, it won't be the factor that stops England qualifying if England don't qualify. I mean, but when I've seen this happen before, when I've seen Ireland and Scotland and Ghana come to Wembley and be given vast allocations because England couldn't sell out and because the demand from the away fans was so huge, I've seen extremely motivated, galvanised away teams, and that's for friendly matches. I think it is slightly bizarre that the FA have gone in this direction.
Well,
I know there's a security...
What could the FA have done? I mean, if this had been England playing Scotland or the Republic of Ireland, presumably there would have been a whole bunch of people there supporting, because there's a lot of people who support Ireland and Scotland who live in England, right?
Well, what they said they were doing was selling only initially to fans with previous history of buying England tickets, because that way they knew that they were going into the right hands, etc. So eventually they end up with this situation where the Poles have bought their 8,000 tickets already, and there's a huge demand for more, and they decide, well, rather than risk ending up with Poles all over the stadium, we'll end up with we'll give them an extra 10,000 ticket, give them an 18,000 allocation to be a huge area of Poles within the ground. Now, personally, Tony Barrett tweeted this morning that it says a lot about what we're used to with away ticket allocations that this is even being talked about. But I do find it slightly sort of damning of the FA, who only give sort of 25,000 tickets per team for an FA Cup final, and yet they've got 18,000 plus away fans from Poland for this must-win.
Sorry, you say from
World
Poland
Cup qualifier at home.
You could correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm under the impression that these aren't 18,000 fans from Poland. That these 10,000.
No, you know what I mean.
Well, no, but these are people who reside in the UK, right?
Yes. Well, I mean, the 10,000 were sold locally, I believe, to Poles, or were sold to satisfy a demand from UK-based Poles, which, obviously there's, I think it's in excess of 500,000 Poles in the UK, and that's so that's understandable that there would be that enormous demand. But I mean, you would not expect if it was a Champions League final group game or something like that, if it was Manchester United versus Legia Warsaw, you wouldn't expect them to give a quarter of the
they don't give them the tickets. They put them for general
away fans, would you?
I'm sorry, Ollie, but I know this has happened with Chelsea, certainly might have happened with Manchester United as well, right? In Champions League games, when if they don't sell out and you get the season ticket holders and the club members and so on, at some point these tickets go on general sale, right? Isn't that all that's happened here? These tickets have gone on general sale rather than having empty seats. They said, let's put them on general sale.
No. It wasn't that. It was those extra 10,000 Polish tickets were released before they went on general sale in England. And it's only in the final few days in the build up to the game that the entire game has been sold out from an England fan's point of view. So I mean, no doubt, if they'd really wanted to get a full house at the expense of everything else, they could probably have just said, "Oh yeah, general sale."
Pretty amazing.
Poles have all the tickets you like, but personally, I think it's a, it seems like a decision where sort of finance and security have absolutely outweighed normal football considerations, because you wouldn't normally expect a big nation to, if we can call ourselves that, a big nation to hand over 18,000 tickets to away fans for a crucial must-win World Cup qualifier. I mean, I'm not saying it's a massive deal, but I think the story has merit, and I think it might, in some small way, backfire on the FA in England if Poland produce the kind of performance that looks like they've been energised by a huge away following.
Now, in our debate this week, we're going to look at Cardiff, because obviously there's plenty of speculation going on. For those unfamiliar with Cardiff, because they've only been a Premier League side for a few months, Cardiff is a team from the city of Cardiff, the eponymous city of Cardiff, in Wales. They were bought by a very wealthy man named Vincent Tan, who decided to change the club colors from blue, which, as everybody knows, brings bad luck, as evidenced by the fact that only Brazil have won more World Cups than Italy, and very few countries wearing red have ever won World Cups. In fact, I believe it's only happened twice. But anyway, I digress here, just to remind everybody we are in a World Cup year. And he decided to put a lot of money in the club. They were promoted last year with their manager, Malky Mackay. As you probably know, this season they've had some very good games, including beating Manchester City. Now, here's the rub. Malky Mackay has a friend named Ian Moody, who is the club's head of recruitment. Cardiff spent a lot of money in the summer. Vincent Tan decided to dismiss Mr. Moody and replace him with a man named Alisher Absalyamov, who Rory and I have known for years.
Absolutely.
We've known him for the last 15 years, since he was 8 years old. No, that's a joke, because Absalyamov is only 23 years old. He's the acting head of recruitment. Ollie, I want to throw this to you first, because you wrote about it very eloquently on Saturday. Viewed from the outside, this story writes itself. Mad, wealthy foreign owner, doesn't know much about football, puts a lot of money in the team.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings. so you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Decides he wants to get involved and so puts his son's mate in charge of player recruitment. Is it as simple as that?
I think that's a neat summary. You could say it's as simple as that. I mean, there are always more complicating factors. There's the fact that as you say, Tan has put in a lot of money. He's stabilised the club from a financial point of view, but as so often, stability from a financial point of view is undermined by complete instability and interference from a football point of view, where an owner gets involved with something he doesn't know about and then, you know, starts to think that he knows best, or surrounds himself with people who he feels know better than the manager. And you know, you could say it's Roman Abramovich on a small scale. But I hope that in this instance we're not going to get an Abramovich style outcome, because I think Malky Mackay is probably the best thing about Cardiff City.
Everybody, now I've heard and reading in all the papers, you know, Ian Moody's described as the much respected Ian Moody. Now, I don't know Ian Moody from Adam. I can judge the players he bought this summer. Gary Medel is one of my favorite players in the world. I think they spent way too much money for him. In fact, I know for a fact that he was offered to other clubs for 8 million euros, and they spent considerably more than that on him. They bought Cornelius, where the judgment's out on him. I don't think we've seen too much of him yet. But can you tell us a little bit about Ian Moody? Because ultimately, this seems to be the sort of the crux of the matter. You know, it's not like as if he's let Malky Mackay go; he's let their de facto, I think, director of football go.
You often hear in these situations about someone being a football man, or you know, a classic football background and years of experience. I mean, Ian Moody is somebody who is perhaps the opposite of that. He's come up through a very unorthodox route in football. He went to university, he worked for an Atol Stills agency in London.
Atol Still, for those who don't know.
You
mentioned Atol Still there, but I think it's interesting that Atol Still used to be he was the man who represented Sven-Göran Eriksson. He's a former opera singer and represents a whole bunch of opera singers. And he produced the CD for a group called Il Divo, which is for blokes singing opera, which I know Cass and I really enjoy. Sorry, proceed.
Right, okay, thank you. interestingly, in 1999, took up a position as staff writer with the website football365.com. So, you know, we're coming full circle with this podcast. But he also was a press officer at Watford, but then, this is the significant bit, he became football operations manager. So although he's come through quite an unorthodox non-football route, he has been working in the football industry and sort of on the football operations side for several years now, and is indeed well respected, not least by Malky Mackay, which probably matters more.
It's an interesting one because, Roy, you and I, being sort of pretentious, foreign-loving types, we talk about directors of football and we talk about how great they are. We talk about, you know, not putting everything into the hands of ex-players, who many times aren't very well educated, or some of them aren't very clever, some of them are. So this guy does seem to, based on Ollie's description of him, does seem to fit the bill. Do you suspect it's a case of Tan taking advice from other people, or looking at the amount of money spent, or looking at why did we sign Cornelius if he's not playing?
Possibly. I mean, the way it's been presented is that Tan's looked at it and said, we've spent all this money, and yet, you know, it's not like we're going to win the Premier League. We're not in the top four. There seems to be an issue around Vincent Tan's patience for how to grow a club in the Premier League. That does seem to be a problem.
So you really believe that? I mean, I don't know Tan perfectly. I'm assuming he's not a freaking moron.
No.
I'm assuming he didn't think that he'd be going up and competing for the Premier League straight away.
Well, you would assume that. And as you say, we have to look at all owners, foreign or not, in the Premier League, and assume that because they're quite rich, they're not stupid, because it's very hard to become rich if you are stupid.
Unless
you inherit the money. And also, or get lucky, look at the fella who won the lottery. Anyway, let's assume that Vincent Tan's not stupid. The issue, probably more broadly, is that there have been examples of owners who've come up and don't understand why that success that they've had in the Championship does not continue flawlessly, seamlessly in the Premier League. The issue with Moody, I don't think, is that he's well respected or not well respected or whatever. I think, and I don't have a problem particularly with, if Cardiff have seen this Kazakh fella and thought, you know what, he's quite good, he can spot a player, I don't think that's a bad thing either necessarily. We don't know if that's the case. Doesn't matter. It's irrelevant that he was a painter and decorator beforehand. It's a weird sort of snobbery about him. The problem is that Tan and Simon Lim, the chief executive, have done this, and it has destabilised Malky Mackay, who basically has done all that could be asked of him. He's taken Cardiff up. He spent a lot of money.
Do we know that Malky Mackay is unhappy with this?
Yes, I think we do.
Has Malky Mackay spoken, or has he just delivered messages via his friends in the media?
He has to be unhappy about it, Gab. Why? Come on. Why? Because he's...
What if it was his idea to get rid of Moody?
I think we would have found that out, don't you?
What? I think if it had been his idea to get rid of Moody, I don't think it would have been such an issue.
No. And I just think that Malky Mackay will probably say, you know, if you didn't believe Ian Moody's the right person for the job, why would you think then that Malky Mackay was the man for the job?
Because you're two different people. Mackay is a coach who coaches a team and selects the players, right?
Gab, you're probably chopping off his right arm. Because most clubs, most guys have people they trust, believe in, and it was part of the success. He would argue, if we had him now, I guarantee that Malky Mackay would be defending Ian Moody and saying, what a great relationship, what a great job he felt he did. You mentioned about transfers. He brought in Stephen Caulker as well from Tottenham. You know, it was a big major coup for Cardiff.
A lot of money too.
Gab, it wasn't that much money considering, you know, it was an England, you know, under 21, highly thought of within the game, had established himself at Tottenham, gets himself to Cardiff. That was a pretty big, bold move that Cardiff did. So I find probably Malky's probably keeping quiet because, like most managers in this sort of position, they're under contract and good contracts for a period of time. And I think he probably, from the outside, is for us, I would believe in the inside, he'd be a very angry man.
Ollie, I want to give you the final word in your column. You described Vincent Tan as an angel of death.
An angel of death? Well, no, I mean, let's be fair about this.
I like getting biblical.
Cardiff were in severe, severe financial danger when Tan and friends took over the club. So, you know, they have had some positive impact, certainly. I mean, they are now a financially stable Premier League club. I just don't think they are a stable club. Stable financially, yes, but everything else about the club smacks of instability and dubious decisions and a sort of... excessive regard for what Tan and his friends know and what the rest of the world doesn't know. It's this sort of culture of your name's on the door, so you can do what you like. I mean, we haven't even mentioned the change from blue shirts to red shirts. That, you know, the rebranding of Cardiff City, which I know, you know, people can say, oh, it's only a shirt, it doesn't matter. I think even if you are completely cold and unsentimental about that decision, it is symptomatic of a culture of I know best, you know, what the fans think and what football people think and heritage and tradition and knowledge and expertise, that doesn't matter. We know best. And I think it's a difficult situation. I don't really like it. I can see that Cardiff have done well under his ownership, and I'm sure a lot of the fans would much rather they are in the Premier League under Tan's ownership playing in red than mid-table in the Championship. But I think there are also fans who would have preferred it the old way, that they feel that the soul has been sold, and they probably look down the M4 to Swansea City and think, oh, you know.
Of course, Swansea is still red.
It would be nice to have the best of both worlds like Swansea do.
All right, time now for some quick hits. Now, we've had a suggestion from one of my many, 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 although not as many as Ollie Kay, followers on Twitter, that we should rebrand Quick Hits as One-on-One. So this week, and only this week, we're going to do a test market. I'm going to call it One-on-One, and feel free to share your thoughts with us on this massive sea change. You can email gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk.
Will it be the same format, just with a different title?
I'll just have to find
out. Like Hull City Tinders.
You just have to find out. Time now for some One-on-One. Joey Barton told Leaders in Football last week that England values managers, not coaches, and then said that Sir Alex Ferguson couldn't put on a coaching session if his life depended on it. Now, I'm sure Joey was exaggerating a little bit. Cass, like Joey, you've never been coached by Sir Alex. Still, tell me, do we overemphasize manager types, or do real men earn their bacon on the training pitch?
Well, the game is changing, and there are, I think, that the new breed are a bit of both. They can manage and they can coach, and they can take training sessions. I've had many a manager who couldn't take training sessions, Big Jack notably, but he had an incredible knowledge of the game and how teams played. He used to go through every style of Scandinavian football, Eastern Bloc football, Brazilian, South American. And
if he wasn't with you on the training pitch, what was it all in his head?
Because he instilled a way of playing that he wanted us to stick by. It was very basic.
But he didn't do it during training sessions?
No, not
but
at all.
He did it at the
bar?
No,
he just told you. He would just say, don't do that. Don't do that type of pass. And okay, it seemed very basic, but we all knew his ideas. And there's also, I've been on coaching courses when I must say, and I don't want to name any names, I've had guys that we've ended up calling the Riddler, because his coaching sessions were, you've got to go in there, come out there, go there, and everyone was like, what we got? Can we hear that again? You know, and they were so incredibly detailed that you just could not take that information onto the football field. So finding the middle ground for me is the real answer.
That's an insight into how Gillingham will play under Tony Castorino, 11-1.
There you go. Hey, for my part, having spent a tiny bit of time with Sir Alex, I think Joey Barton might have had a good point. I don't think Sir Alex Ferguson was a good example of this at all, based on what so many people have told me. Greg Dyke has put together a commission which in the next 6 months will look at the English game. Gary Lineker, in one of his many tweets, called most of these folks pointless. Ollie, what would you call them? And are the Premier League unpatriotic and mean and horrible for not agreeing to be a part of Greg Dyke's commission?
Well, I'm disappointed the Premier League aren't involved.
So they should be.
I'm guessing that they will not. I'm guessing that they will comply, and they will have different people answering to the commission and giving answers. But it means that they are already probably disassociating and distancing themselves from the final findings, which it was meant to be this sort of whole game approach to a shake-up of English football. So that's slightly disappointing, but maybe they can have good feedback and good input in other ways. As for the makeup of the panel, well, I'm more interested to see the people that they speak to than the and take advice from, rather than the actual makeup of the panel. I think the makeup of the panel is slightly overstated. I don't think it's of huge importance whether they have a load of ex-players and coaches, or whether they have a few bureaucrats on there. Personally, I would like to see somebody like Gary Neville have a big voice in this process, but I think he would probably be better at answering the questions rather than asking them.
I think we should have had a panel of one, and it should have been Roger Burden. But, Ollie, just a quick follow-up on this. It's really clear to me. I was told that the Premier League guy he wanted to have on there was Anthony Frye. Is that right?
Yeah.
And I'm sure most people have no idea who on God's green earth Anthony Frye is. Can you tell us?
He's a Premier League. He's a Premier League chairman. He's he's.
What did he do before that?
He invented the fries, peppermint cream,
and Turkish delight. He is Barry Frye's brother as well. No, that's not true either.
No.
Board of directors, chairman right. types.
With no past in football, yeah.
He's a big Manchester United fan.
This is what gets
me. Outrage.
No, but this is what gets me right about the Premier League. If this guy, I'm sure he's very clever, but he's a chairman, right? He's got nothing to do with the Premier League. He's just been appointed. He hasn't been there very long. If you're going to do it, you have Scudamore on or somebody who actually works in an executive capacity if you want to get the know-how on, if you're going to do it. If you're going to get this guy on, you know, you might as well get, you know, a waxwork dummy on because he's not been involved in it. Just my two cents.
I do totally agree. I think it's an excess of chairman, not enough executives, not enough administrators. I don't quite, you know, if it had been Dave Richards, who was his predecessor, then I'd have been even more worried. But
that's for different, that's a whole set of different reasons.
Football is extremely disconcerting. But it's, I agree with you. It should be administrators and executives if we're talking bureaucrats.
Rory, you wrote movingly and compellingly about Bosnia and what qualification would mean to them. For those who, unlike me, did not read your piece, why is this such a compelling story?
Because it's less than 20 years since Bosnia was not even a recognised nation, since it was still sort of coming to terms with the after effects of a brutal and savage war.
Yeah. So Slovenia got to a World Cup and they weren't a nation not that long ago.
But I think, and that Slovenia's achievement was incredible getting to 2002, but especially, I think they're still the smallest European nation ever to qualify. But with Bosnia, because of the sort of the mix of the ethnicities in the country, because of the tripartite system, which means that in every sphere of public life, you have a Bosniak president, a Serb president, and a Croat president, except in football, where because of Ivica Rosim's commission two or three years ago, which FIFA sort of forced upon the Bosnians, they have one president, a mixed sort of ethnic team, which is a really powerful example, I think, for the rest of the country, that if they can qualify, that may be the different ethnic groups within Bosnia, who still share a lot of tension, can kind of work together. And I think it's easy to say this with football, to say, oh, football can be a great example for the rest of the country and blah blah blah, and it's quite trite. But I think in Bosnia's case, it's also quite true that if they can qualify for the World Cup, it is a powerful sort of statement about the future of the nation.
It's a really great tale, and if you haven't done so already, go back and check it out. Cass, your peeps at the Republic of Ireland don't have a national team manager, and I'm told that Martin O'Neill is now 11-10, apparently.
If Cass turns down the Gillingham job, he's in for Ireland.
Exactly. Would you take the Ireland job if offered, if you don't go to Gillingham? And secondly, is Martin O'Neill the right man if you're unavailable?
Mm. I'm unavailable. Looks cosy. Obviously, the Celtic connection. He's a huge favourite in Ireland. The Federation are very worried about empty seats at the stadium, the Aviva Stadium, because there's no euphoria. It's been a very difficult period, especially the last few games. They're looking for a guy that would get backsides back on seats, and Martin would fit that bill in Ireland. Do I agree with it? I think it's going to end in tears. I don't really feel that Martin will be the right man, but I can understand every reason for why the Federation do want to employ him.
I think they should appoint Adnan Januzaj and then naturalize him as soon as they can. Uh-oh. Media outlets in Spain are now reporting that Gareth Bale has some kind of chronic herniated disc. Real Madrid deny this. They're saying that he's got a chronic bulge instead, not a chronic hernia. Ollie, that's not very clever, given that he's the most expensive player ever. You're the closest thing this panel has to a qualified medical physician.
Correct.
What I don't get is, if this story is true, should it not have turned up when he did his medical? And also, 2 years ago, didn't he start every single Premier League game for Tottenham Hotspur?
Yeah, but Bale is one of those players who, I mean, even in the past year or so, he has the look, and I'm told has the body of somebody who has to be sort of finely tuned almost every day. He's got this sort of he's got an extremely powerful yet fragile physique, which does leave a certain susceptibility of to injuries. I mean, you think of Ryan Giggs; he had to sort of micromanage his body through yoga, etc., for a long period of time. And there have been a few of these suggestions regarding Bale that although he's a monster physically, he is going to have to be very careful to avoid injuries, and he did suffer injuries last season. So it's I think it's one that's definitely worth watching and worth perhaps worrying about, perhaps particularly if you've just spent £80 million on him. Why it didn't come up in the medical, I don't know. Well, it probably did come up in the medical, but they probably decided, you know, we are going for this come what may, and they'll live with the consequences. But it is a concern, because I think if you looked at Bale 2 years, 2 years, 3 years ago, you would have said the big problem, the big risk he will have is staying fit, because he is that type of player who looks susceptible to injury. And this would seem to bear that out, because spinal problems do tend to spread and have knock-on effects elsewhere in the body.
Right. I think we're both in agreement as to what the single best story is out of all the qualifiers on Tuesday. Tell me just how great a story this is. And Roy doesn't know what I expect him to say, and I'm guessing, but there's a game Tuesday that he should be quite familiar with, especially one of the managers involved.
Well, I was going to say that the best story in the qualifiers is Bosnia, but we've already done that.
Mm-hmm, there's another one.
Are we talking European?
No, don't be so Eurocentric.
Egypt.
Yes.
Yes. Egypt, Ghana. Yes.
Why is that a good story?
Well, because Egypt are the best side in Africa, have been for the last sort of 10 years. They've not made it to the World Cup. They have an American coach in Bob Bradley, who's a lovely man, who I met in Cairo in a hotel in Zamalek, who is a great story, because obviously Egypt, with all the revolution going on and the sort of chaos of the Black Bloc and the Brotherhood and all that stuff, Bob Bradley is living in the middle of Cairo, which is an incredible sort of statement from him. And with any luck, I mean, this is not sort of any disrespect to Ghana, but with any luck, Bob Bradley will take Egypt to Brazil, where I think they'd be capable of causing a bit of a surprise, to be perfectly honest.
Egypt, who, despite having been so good in Africa, of course, don't have a great record at World Cup qualifying.
And of course, you've got the whole kind of Port Said angle, you've got the Ali Zamalek angle, the two rival clubs. It's a fantastic story. The possibility of seeing Mohamed Aboutrika, if he's still going in 2014, which is not
Mohamed
sure.
Aboutrika, who was dubbed by me the greatest player in the world outside of Europe and South America. Of course, that was back in 2009.
They can't play at home, can they?
Well, there's a big security issue for the home leg. It's a phenomenal story, and given all these dead rubbers and stuff, I recommend you go and check this out.
The other great story, of course, is Iceland. That's the other great story. Nation with 320,000 people in it potentially qualifying for the World Cup. They'll need a playoff. They should finish second behind Switzerland. That's a fantastic story as well. International football is very interesting if you don't watch England.
Or you don't watch England or Spain or Germany. Yeah, don't watch anybody good, basically.
Yeah, just watch the smaller nations. That's where international football matters. And Gab, I've got a question for you, and it's very interesting. Back in March of 2010, roughly a year after I mentioned it, you suggested that Belgium might be the smart tip for the 2014 World Cup. How is your prediction working out? I'm guessing it's well, because otherwise you wouldn't have brought it up.
Yes, the difference is that when you mentioned it back in March of 2009, you mentioned it in your head. Whereas I mentioned it in these very pages in the game, in the Times. And that's why, people still come to me. I get calls from Belgium almost every week about my incredibly prescient powers. Belgium are doing extremely well, what I think is remarkable. I think you could even argue that, except for Germany and Spain, they have more depth of talent than any other nation in Europe. What is absolutely fascinating to me is people are looking at them now as like case studies. What have Belgium done? The Belgian model. You talk to people in Belgium, and they generally say, you know what? We just had this incredible generation of freaks of nature, because there really is no common thread to how all these people came together. Some of them were educated in Belgium. Some of them were educated in Holland. Hazard, of course, educated football-wise in France. And the scary thing is their under-21s are very good as well. And they've got this whole little brother thing going on. Torgan Hazard and Jordan Lukaku, of course, lining up for the under-21s together with Yannick Ferreira Carrasco, who I think is one of the most exciting young forwards in Europe. And I hope he gets into the World Cup team. That's all we've got time for the time being, it says here. But you can come see us live in Birmingham a week from Thursday. The links are on Twitter and our SoundCloud page, too. Thanks to my guests, the very talented Tony Cascarino, the very handsome Ollie Kay, and Rory Smith. Reach out to us, gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. So many of us do. Also, Ollie and Rory in particular, and myself too. We all love hearing from people on Twitter. Till next time, bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Cross Wires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.